From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Stockton, California.
I live next door to Bob Saget.
Selma.
Rockridge.
Tracy, California.
Noe Valley.
Everywhere, I'm homeless.
Coming up, the question of how to manage a not-so-old growth forest on San Francisco's Mount Sutro.
A lot of people walk out here and they see green and they think, wow, green. The area is healthy, it's lush. But there's good green and there's bad green.
Then an Oakland dancer talks about the role art can play in social justice movements.
Growing up in a Pacific Islander household, movement was always a form of storytelling.
And we visit an East Bay pet store that's not exactly warm and fuzzy.
Bearded dragons especially, their mating rituals are completely barbaric. I wish it was a polite dance, but it's more like Miley Cyrus twerking.
We're venturing out today on Cross Currents. Here in drought-stricken California, we're still grappling with a dangerous fire season. The Loma Fire, which started on Monday, is currently making its way through the Santa Cruz Mountains and covers over 2,250 acres. The Bay Area is no stranger to devastating fires, though. Back in October 1991, a fire raged in the Oakland Hills.
Scenes of pure terror in the Oakland-Berkeley Hills. This location near the Caldecott Tunnel was one of the first hit by the fire. The fierce flames here had people running for their lives through an inferno of intense heat and smoke.
The fire killed 25 people and destroyed more than 3,000 homes. It was so destructive in part because of the many eucalyptus trees found throughout the Oakland Hills. Eucalyptus are highly flammable. When ignited, they can explode. They're such a hazard, federal emergency officials and local agencies have been developing plans to thin them out for years. But the plans continue to be thwarted by lawsuits and protests from people who want to conserve the forest. Just this week, a month before the trees were scheduled to begin coming down, the plan was stalled yet again. There's a similar controversy in the middle of San Francisco, amongst the eucalyptus trees on Mount Sutro. UCSF, which owns the land, will present its plan for managing the risk of fire to the public next month. KALW's Resu Sussman first reported on it back in 2013. Here's her story.
It's a rare sunny morning on Mount Sutro, and I'm hiking up with Rupa Bose. Bose lives in the Forest Knolls neighborhood, just down the hill, and she only discovered the forest a few years ago.
It was a shock to me that you could come out of a very ordinary San Francisco neighborhood full of houses and cars and step into this forest, and it was birds and the wind in the trees, and you can... It doesn't feel like being in the city at all. So, yeah, it's simply gorgeous.
Bose now hikes here a few times a week, and she's a member of Save Sutro.
I'm sorry it's not a foggy day, because you should see this place when it's acting like a cloud forest. There's an understory of various plants, but I would say that blackberry predominates. There are some vines climbing up the trees. I don't see any of them having reached into the canopy. They're just climbing the trunks. And I have heard that unlike kudzu, which climbs into the canopy, climbs out onto the branches and strangles the trees, these ivies don't do that. They just climb the trunks and then stay put.
Later that week, I go on another hike up on Mount Sutro. This time, I'm with Craig Dawson. He grew up right below the forest, also in the Forest Knolls neighborhood. He loves it up here, has for half a century, and now he coordinates the trail maintenance and planting for the Sutro Stewards. He looks at the forest differently than Bose, starting with the ivy.
So the English ivy is one of the largest problems that we have out here. The English ivy will climb into the crowns of the trees, and it actually kills the tree that it's climbing eventually. Not instantly, but over a period of years. A lot of people walk out here and they see green and they think, wow, green. The area is healthy, it's lush. But there's good green and there's bad green. And when you want to evaluate a forest and you want to talk about management, you have to take a look at what is actually beneficial and what is actually harmful. We were just talking about the ivy climbing into the trees. That's harmful. We have two types of ivy. We have cape ivy, which is the light green stuff down here. And we have the English ivy, which is way up in the tops of some trees.
Two hikes, two conversations with people who love this place, yet two very different perspectives on where it's at now. To understand the forest, we need to look at its roots. How did it even come to be here in the middle of the city? In the 1860s and 70s, a German immigrant named Adolf Sutro made millions in Nevada's Comstock Lode silver mine. He came to San Francisco and invested in real estate. A lot of real estate. Sutro eventually owned 1/12 of San Francisco, including what was then called Blue Mountain. Sutro called it Mount Parnassus, and it is now known as Mount Sutro. To celebrate San Francisco's very first Arbor Day in 1886, Sutro planted thousands of trees on his extensive property, mainly blue gum eucalyptus. And before he died at the turn of the century, Sutro gave some of his land on top of Blue Mountain to UCSF. The land hosted a lumber mill. Ishii lived there. The military had part of its Nike missile defense system up there. But from the late 1970s through the late 90s, the forest was pretty much left alone.
We have owls. There's a couple different types. We have the hawks that are up here. And you can witness that quite frequently along these trails where you'll see the signs of something having been recently devoured. We have coyotes sighted up here regularly. We have the raccoons and skunks and possum. Years ago, we used to have red-tailed fox up here.
Craig Dawson tells me there was even a mountain lion spotted a few years ago, so it's pretty wild for an urban forest. But the unchecked growth could keep it from being
a healthy forest, a safe forest, a beautiful forest, and an accessible forest.
That's Barbara Baggett-Lopez, the Director of Community Relations for UCSF. The university has a forest management plan, originally developed in the late 90s after a community feedback process.
We're going to work to thin the trees and to remove underbrush. So it's a more open understory. You can say, stand back, neighbors, UCSF, experts, whoever, can stand back and say, do I like that or do I not like it?
Rupa Bose of Save Sutro does not like it.
Talking about removing 90% of the understory, mowing down 90% of the understory in the demonstration areas.
Bose's estimate is based on the most severe scenarios in the draft environmental impact report. And Sutro Stewards Craig Dawson?
That will never happen. It's just not a possibility.
Whether it's a lot of cutting or a little, UCSF's Barbara Baggett-Lopez says,
we'll have to see how people react to it. The other thing about visual effects, and it really isn't something you can see immediately, but when you enable trees to thrive, then their canopies open up more, and you can kind of look around Mount Sutro and see, boy, that's a scrawny tree. That's one that's pretty scrawny too. But if they have room to breathe and room to actually make use of the nutrients in the soil, the canopies end up filling out. So it's much, much more fuller and much healthier looking.
Managing an urban space isn't easy. The more people who use it, the more opinions there are on what should be done with it, and the longer it can take to actually implement a plan. But whether they like it or not, the regular hikers on Mount Sutro will see a different forest sometime next year, probably. On Mount Sutro, I'm Resu Sussman for Cross Currents.
That story originally aired in 2013. Barbara Baggett-Lopez retired from her position at UCSF last year. UCSF will present its plans for managing the Mount Sutro Eucalyptus Grove in October. For more information about the public comment process, go to klw.org, click Cross Currents.
Thank you.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Our next story is about a dancer who's making a name for himself, both as an artist and an activist. Spulu communicates his passion for social justice through his choreography style. It draws on his Pacific Islander heritage and love of hip-hop. Spulu talked with KLW's Jen Chien about the importance of art in movements for social change.
So you found dance at an early age,
yes.
Right? Can you tell me what your earliest memory is of dance or of dancing?
Funny story. The umbilical cord was wrapped around my neck at birth.
Uh-huh.
So when I started taking dance seriously later on in life, my mom was like, I knew you were going to be a dancer. The umbilical cord was wrapped around your neck. In her
womb. She was saying that you were turning around in the womb.
Yeah, and I came out with the umbilical cord wrapped around my neck. So I guess that was kind of my like embryo start of dance, and then moved on.
Yeah, it was meant to be.
To Pacific Islander movement, specifically Tongan.
And that's where your family is from.
That's
from
where
Tonga.
My mother and father's from, my family's from.
And when did you start that, learning that dance?
Church. I grew up in a Mormon household.
Were your parents born in Tonga?
My parents were both born in Tonga. They both moved to the United States.
And were they born into Mormon families in Tonga?
My father was. My mother was converted later on when she moved here.
Uh-huh.
Migrated back in the 80s. Upbringing also with movement also was a part of our daily lives in terms of not just performing at church events, but family reunions.
Did your whole family dance and perform?
My whole family performed growing up. Some gender bending growing up. It was weird because growing up, it was just for the entertainment of my mother's own like creative process of like.
She was your choreographer.
She was. She had us one time. Had all the boys, there's five boys, had the boys dressed in like women's attire. And then she played a male role. And I think within that sparked a lot in terms of like, I've been doing a lot of these queer gender bending role playing at an early age, but didn't have a vocabulary to identify a lot of what my mom was doing, even though she came from a conservative background.
So you recently graduated from San Francisco State,
yes,
with a degree in dance with an emphasis in race and resistance studies.
Yes,
so
yes.
First, shout out to San Francisco State for giving out a degree like that.
Yes, yes.
But you're very clear about using your art for social change.
Right.
It sounds like that's what you were studying at school. Can you talk about how those two are related, interrelated for you?
Growing up in a Pacific Islander household, Tongan household, movement was always a form of storytelling. So it was always a space where I was making connections to a disconnection that I had with the Tongan community and the living in the island, whereas living in America was different and having to conform to different, the school lifestyle, because at school it was different, church it was different, and at home it was different. So there was a lot of early signs of oppression and a lot of trauma that was circulating amongst my family and the community and within myself. So recognizing that I had those illnesses in myself and seeing that it's not just me, it was impacting my whole community. Because I found movement as a way to navigate through those feelings, that's when I realized in high school that there was more to be done than do a lot of like hip-hop commercial dancing that I was already doing.
Kind of not just fun or not just stuff that looks cool, but
right,
there's something deeper there.
2014 or 2013, after the death of Alex Nieto, who was a classmate of mine at City College of San Francisco.
And Alex Nieto is the young man who was killed by San Francisco police.
Yes, correct.
In Bernal Heights in San
Francisco.
Yes,
yes. That took a toll on me because I've experienced police brutality, but I didn't make a connection to like, that was messed up. It's not fixed. There's something that's strategically happening in communities like Oakland, San Francisco. So I created this piece in response to bringing awareness.
You've chosen this path of an artist and an activist. We haven't explicitly talked about it, but you identify as a queer person.
Yes, yes.
And you grew up in a very conservative Mormon household and religious atmosphere. So
right.
How has your family dealt with the path that you've chosen in life.
Right. I know this is going to go live, and I know some of my family members are going to be hearing this for the first time. Like, I identify as queer, whatever that means to them. To a lot of my family, it means just gay, and just gay, 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 and snap, snap, snap. And then some is just like, Mahu. Mahu in Hawaii is like transgender, transitioning out of like your biological being into your spiritual gains. And growing up, a lot of times when we were performing, like a lot of like gender bending like performances with my family, it was just, for them, it was a form of entertainment. For me, it was liberating. I love when I was putting my mom's heels on and that dress, that like I can queen out a little bit and be okay. But there wasn't a space for queer folks to come out, and it was very hard for me to express that to my family. And it's still hard to this day to talk about queer issues. And this year I'm coming out now, so for me, I'm just sick and tired of like the ignorance that comes within our own Pacific Islander community, because in history, in her story, in our stories, there's a lot of Pacific Islanders in the South Pacific who are accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so weird that
it's part of the cultural tradition in a lot of places.
There were the spiritual healers in Hawaii, in Tonga and Samoa, to play both roles, to have the masculine harvester who goes out and picks the crops, and then the nurturer who can take care of mom and dad when they're like in their 80s or 90s and take care of the newborns, while if my sister wants to go work, I can be that caregiver. So by me coming now, I want to, you know, bring that memory back in terms of like, it's part of our culture to have queer folks navigate through the community and be the rock in the community, because we can communicate with both groups.
That was dancer and choreographer Spulu speaking with KLW's Jen Sheehan. Spulu will be participating in Queer Fashion Week in Oakland. That's September 28th through October 2nd. For more information, go to kalw.org and click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. That sound you hear isn't radio interference. It's scratching.
And you can hear one of our big monitors scratching at the corner of his cage.
That's reptile enthusiast Owen Merks at the East Bay Vivarium. And he's talking about a giant lizard called an Argus monitor. This scratching Argus monitor lives with about 10,000 other animals at the East Bay Vivarium, a specialty reptile and amphibian shop on 5th Street in Berkeley. It's been operating for more than 40 years as both a store and a hands-on educational center of sorts. Plenty of visitors stop by to just wander around, checking out species they may not have seen before. Sometimes staff members will even take a reptile or two out of their cages so visitors can get up close and personal. Those visitors included KALW's Rachel Wong.
Somebody asked me to put these guys, asked me to put a pair of the $20.
I'm standing in the back of the bustling East Bay Vivarium with its co-owner, Owen Merks. We're looking through the glass of a large cage at a lizard that's nearly as long as I am tall.
His name is Elmo. He's a good guy. People love him.
Elmo is a giant black throat monitor. He looks nothing like the Sesame Street Muppet with the same name, but apparently their personalities have some things in common.
People don't expect that an animal that big and fearsome looking is actually a big sweetheart, but he is.
I don't totally see it, but I'll take his word for it. We move on to the next cage. The Vivarium feels a lot like a neighborhood hardware store, but instead of drills or bolts, There are rows of turtles, frogs, lizards, and the occasional aquarium accessories. Down crowded aisles where you might otherwise find toilet snakes, the snakes on display here are real.
Right now we're walking down our monitor aisle, which is our large lizards and large boa constrictors and pythons, and assorted other odds and ends.
When he says large, he means it. The albino Burmese python in the corner cage is over 15 feet long.
One of the reasons we have the giant snakes in here is some stores will sell a baby python without ever giving anybody the indication of what to expect. So we like to have examples of what is this gonna turn into.
It's important people know what they're getting into because otherwise they end up back at the store, returning pets they can't take care of. That's how the vivarium gets some of its animals. Others are purchased from wholesalers, and others come from the breeding room in the back of the store. That room is filled with incubators and baby animals, and it's off limits to customers. So we move down the next aisle. Merckx takes a small snake out of its cage for a closer look.
Fantastically beautiful pattern on top. Nobody could deny that, right?
Yeah. Could I touch him?
Sure. Oh. But flip it over. There's a totally different pattern there.
Wow,
equally nice.
The black and white pattern on the underbelly of the bright orange corn snake looks undeniably cool, like piano keys, and feels slippery. I suddenly wonder if I should be wary about touching any of these reptiles.
We have some mildly venomous snakes. Nothing I would consider dangerous. Probably the most dangerous animal we have in the store in terms of venom is beaded lizards. So a lizard that's venomous, and it won't kill you, but it might make you wish you wanted to die.
Turns out the beaded lizard Merckx is talking about is in a cage near my feet. I'm only mildly reassured by its metal lock as I scurry past. The vivarium has been open less than an hour, and it's already abuzz, mostly with people picking up pet supplies, workers caring for animals, and the occasional kids and parents wandering the aisles.
Look what a good climber he is.
Yep.
Then it's time for a feeding. Manager Carlos Haslam goes to the back room and returns with a yellow chick. That's when my adrenaline really starts pumping.
Yeah, this is called a scrub python. They're one of the largest arboreal snakes on the planet.
Haslam tosses the chick into the python's cage. The snake wraps his body around the chick till it passes out and then takes it whole down the hatch. I can't believe I'm watching this, but Haslam tells me he thinks most people are fascinated by feedings.
Kind of mechanically efficient, don't you think?
So fast.
Efficient, yes. But I'm ready to move on, for sure. The mood finally lightens as we shift our attention to some reptile mating rituals just across the aisle. Haslam pulls a male bearded dragon out of his cage. The lizard immediately notices a female in the cage above him. He stares at her and waves his legs like he's swimming in place.
If he could have access, I'm sure he would be all over her like white on rice.
Haslam tells me that reptiles and amphibians aren't the only ones doing a mating dance at the vivarium.
It's pretty typical. If a woman brings her boyfriend down and the woman pretends to be afraid, then she's looking for the comforts of that man. If a man does it, he might be looking to show his softer side to the woman.
Lovers and lovers of reptiles. I'm starting to wonder about the type of people who take this on as a hobby.
The face of the hobby is kind of eclectic. We have soccer moms from Danville. We have gangsters from Oakland. We have kids from Marin.
Owen Merckx has his own theory about what makes reptile owners tick.
More traditional pet, saying dogs and cats and the big cytokines, the big birds. People like those because in the end, they're substitute babies. The thing with reptiles and arachnids and things like that is different. It's not you making them into little humans. It's them letting you into their world. And that is as wonderful an experience as you can have. Not being yourself for a little while, that's incredible. That's great.
Possibly even greater than that are these moments of affinity you may end up sharing with an animal so completely different than you. Before I head out, I stop by Rudy the tortoise's cage. He opens his mouth wide and yawns, and I can't help but smile. Who would have thought a tortoise could make my heart melt just a little? In Berkeley, I'm Rachel Wong for Cross Currents.
You can see pictures of some of the creatures found at the East Bay Vivarium at our website, klw.org. Click Cross Currents. And that's our show today. Our team includes Jürgen Klemm, Leela Day, Angela Johnston, Olivia Henry, Meredith Hoddenott, Jeremy Jew, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, James Rollins, Judy Silber, Carrie Spivak, and Andrew Stelzer. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff, and the line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by the Friction Quartet, which is marking 5 years of playing music together with concerts both Thursday and Friday at the Center for New Music in San Francisco. The program starts at 7:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.